100 years ago this week, one of the busiest urban intersections in the country took on the name Times Square. And in the century since, the New York landmark has gone from riches to rags to riches again. But Times Square is best known for screaming crowds on New Year's Eve.
Happy New Year, happy new century, and most would say happy new millennium. Fireworks go off over Times Square, New York.
Joining us here at Times Square is Jim Traub, a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. He's just written The Devil's Playground, A Century of Pleasure and Profit in Times Square. Jim, thanks for being our guide today.
Oh, I'm delighted.
And the first obvious point to make being here is that this is not a square in any sense of the word.
No, you know, one of the things I try to have fun with in the book is that we use the word square in New York for things that aren't squares at all. They're traffic messes. So here, a square is the accidental place where Broadway, the only diagonal street in New York's grid, crosses one of the other avenues. And so Times Square, unlike gracious, gentle, elegant squares, doesn't have grass. It doesn't have little places for children to play. It's an asphalt jungle at the heart of the city.
What happened here 100 years ago?
Two things happened. The most important one is that the subway came through. Already it was at crossroads. Already it was crowded. There was a commercial life here, but not much else. Suddenly, there were millions of people coming through. There were just no other places like that in New York. It was a kind of nexus for this new population that had been coming into the city, all these immigrants. So that was one. The other thing that happened was that Adolph Oakes, the entrepreneur owner of the New York Times, had the brilliant idea of building a building on the teeny tiny funny shaped triangular plot that necessarily lay between the point where 7th Avenue and Broadway crossed at 42nd Street. And so on April 8th, 1904, the then mayor of New York, George McClellan, renamed the square, which had been informally known as Longacre Square, officially as Times Square. And so people would come here around the New York Times building where they would put the news in letters outside the building, and then in the 20s created that famous news zipper that runs around the building.
The crawler.
Right. And so, for example, every presidential election, the big heavyweight fights, they would come.
Here, so, right where we're standing.
Right where we're standing, the whole, all of Times Square, this big open space, would be jammed on all major occasions. This is the place New Yorkers would come to gather.
And so they receive news here about which major events of our
time?
Well,
of course, the most famous one by far is the end of World War II. So we all know that photograph that Alfred Eisenstadt took of the sailor kissing the nurse. That was taken when VJ Day was announced. And people realized earlier that day that it was going to be coming that evening. So starting late in the morning or early in the afternoon, they started to gather.
The greatest, the wildest celebration of them all was in New York's Times Square. Never before or since has there been a crowd like this on the Great White Way. 2 million people screamed their elation at the end of the most devastating war in recorded history.
So we're walking up to the tip of the triangle toward 44th Street, and where, actually, it's the point where all these streets come together. So what can we see from here?
Okay. Right now, we are looking at 44th Street, the corner on the east side of Broadway. We're looking at the Toys R Us building. Now, the space itself is important because the first theater ever built in New York was built here. I think it was the first sign of confidence in this new neighborhood that there could be elegant, high-class entertainment here. So that was 110 years ago. What we're looking at now is Toys R Us. In a lot of ways, it epitomizes the new Times Square. It's bright, it's thronged with people, it's totally successful, and it represents this new world of retail-tainment, which is to say that retail usurps the function that theater used to have. Entertainment now comes in the act of buying things. Times Square has always been a place where the cash register rings, and it's always been about entrepreneurship and making a buck. The one great rule of Times Square is that real estate will always be put to its most profitable use. When movies were more valuable than plays, that was the end of plays. People showed movies. And when pornography was more valuable than the kind of novelty shops that were then popular on 42nd Street and Times Square in the 60s, they became pornography shops. And so it was really just kind of the iron law of the marketplace working itself out in a new environment.
Let's head down there to 42nd Street.
Let's. 42nd Street more than Broadway or the other parts of Times Square is what fell upon hard times in the 1970s and 80s. When people talked about how horrible the place had become, they meant 42nd Street even more than Times Square, because there were so many sex shops there, but also crime was so high. No matter how many cops you put on the beat, there were drug deals. It was a forbidding place. And here it was, the heart of New York City, the most famous urban place in the world, the seat of so many memories, and it had become the symbol of urban failure. And at a time when people thought cities aren't viable anymore, we're all going to move out to the suburbs, Times Square was the proof of the kind of irrecoverable loss of what cities had once been. And I would say even long after it ceased to be elegant and glamorous, when it was already seedy, when it was all hot dog stands, when it had a kind of carny quality, it was still beloved. There was still a sense of life and eccentricity. Above all, it was a place of characters. And so it was the place where individuality was the most untrammeled.
Is it still a place of characters?
You know, that's a hard question to answer. The character that I use to talk about this is the naked cowboy. He is this beautifully bemuscled guy who wears nothing except underpants, even on a really cold day, and carries his guitar. He's a terrible guitarist.
Got to live my own life, no room for compromise.
He's the new street person of Times Square. But the funny thing about him is he's, first of all, unlike other street people, he's in fantastic condition. He works out in the gym most of the time. He's got his own website. And so it's a kind of marketing device for him. Just as, you know, Toys R Us is here because of the branding opportunity, the Naked Cowboy came here having rambled around quite a lot because he realized this was the best marketing opportunity for him, because everybody would get to know who he was through media exposure, and they would go to his website and they'd buy his stuff. And so he seems like the perfect emblem for today's Times Square.
You talk about this strange transformation where at first the impetus for redevelopment was to get rid of all the ugly stuff, basically.
I think what happened was that when the development began in the early 1980s, people were just so horrified about urban life and the squalor of Times Square that all they said was clean it up. Then there were several catalyzing events. One was that the buildings initially proposed to be put up here by Philip Johnson were so corporate in their feel and so inappropriate for this place that I think it reminded people of what it was that it had been before. And so the outcry that greeted those buildings ultimately developed into a move to find some way of ensuring that this whole place didn't suddenly turn into an extension of Sixth Avenue. Elegance, prestige, all that stuff. And people said, wait a minute, that's not what this place is about. And if you do that, you will be eradicating something which we actually care about. And so, as I say, it produced this counter movement.
Before we leave Times Square, we walk a few blocks more through an electronic blizzard of frenetic billboards to one of the lingering remnants of the old Times Square, a Howard Johnson's restaurant with fading Naugahyde booths. What's significant about the transformation that has taken place here?
You know, in the end, I think what my book is about is the dilemma of placemaking. Here was this place with all these meanings and all these memories and myths and so forth, and it disintegrated. And so you had to do something to it. But what do you do? I mean, how do you remake a place, especially a place whose whole nature is that it became what it was spontaneously, through no plan of anybody, just through the sheer force of appetite? What do you do? And so here we have this remade place. And so you can't help but ask the question, is it true to the place that was here before? Is it fair to ask that the place be true to what it was before? Can it in some way be true without being an absurd theme park, a colonial Williamsburg of popular entertainment? And it can't anymore have the sense of locality, particularity, specificity of our place that it had before. That's a loss.
James Traub is the author of The Devil's Playground, A Century of Pleasure and Profit in Times Square. thanks for showing us around today.
It was my pleasure.
Our Times Square interview was produced by Susan Stone and recorded by Manoli Wetherill. View photographs of Times Square and learn more about James Traub's book at our website at npr.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.